questions, asking, just really sinking my teeth into any opportunity, which just led to more and more comedy. And I'm still trying to like break out. Like it's the Forrest Gump metaphor. Like, you know, it's just getting those braces off. Mm. And that'll be a lifetime thing, you know?
Totally.
But that's the journey. And I believe when we avoid the thing we're meant to overcome, we keep getting shown that same level. And that's what, like, for me, spiritual evolution, it's overcoming that level, learning how to respond to adversity, then learning where the adversity is, like sidestepping it completely, and like different ways to leapfrog over it. And what might have been the biggest hang up in my life 10 years ago is done by sunrise. And it's, and then you get presented with the new. The most delicate pursuit, I think, in my life is trying to unleash my inner child, trying to overcome the feeling like people care and the feeling of needing to behave.
Hey, y'all. I'm Reese, and welcome to Making Meaning, a podcast by the Cohere Collective here to help guide you along your path to make meaning in a way that makes sense for you. I'm your host and the founder of the Cohere Collective, Lillian Reese Brown, and today I am joined by comedian, podcaster, digital content creator, actor, husband, father, and all-around lovely human being, Dave Neal. In this conversation, we really cover a lot. It was such an expansive and growth-oriented conversation that not only dives into Dave's own relationship with creativity and being a creator, but how that journey in the external career world mirrors the internal journey of self-growth and the familial journey of inner child work and becoming a father. There's really so many layers here, from internal work to connection in relationships to being a creative human being and living in a world that often wants us to be small and manageable and quiet and governable, shall I say. And I think this conversation serves as a really beautiful reminder that your authenticity, your coherence is your superpower. It's your magic. And it is the spark that reminds you of who you are. And that reminds us that we are alive and that this life that we are living, your authenticity, your coherence is worth expressing. I highly recommend you check out Dave Neal and all of his work. His bi-daily, twice daily is maybe a better way to put that, show called The Rush Hour Podcast will be linked down below. Please go check it out. And all of his other work, including live stand-up shows and just a plethora of things that he is doing, will all be linked down below for you to check out and follow along with. Also, please subscribe or follow wherever you may be listening or watching. That truly is the best way to support the Cohere Collective and the Making Meaning podcast. And come follow us at the Cohere Collective wherever you have social media. It's the best place to stay up to date on all things Making Meaning, Cohere, and learn a little bit more about me and what coherence really means, and get updates on all of the other stuff we're doing too. Okay, that is all I have for you. So as always, let's take a deep breath. And get started. Well, Dave, thank you so much for being here. First and foremost, I really appreciate your time and coming on. I've been really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first question I always like to ask, just to hopefully set a good tone for our conversation, is what is one thing that you're grateful for?
Oh my gosh. You know, I got to go, boy, it's so cliche to say health, but you don't realize until even if you have like a 1 week of being under the weather, when you're in the podcast game and you got to speak out loud. I had my voice was gone last week and I was doing stand-up shows like yelling, like barely getting anything out. So it's, you don't realize till it's gone. I'm getting a little older, trying to keep that health in order now that I have a child. You know, trying to go, oh boy, I'm going to be an old dad. I might as well have my joints working. So health, that's it. I'm grateful for grateful for, you know, the fact that my knees don't crack too bad when I bend over.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think, you know, cliches are cliche for a reason, right? It's like, it's a beautiful thing to be grateful for. And we'll round back to some other things about health and healthcare as well. And that it's a good segue into some of those questions. But I did also just want to start with, what is your story? I always like to ask guests that question just because this is what it's all about, right? Your story, everything that brought you to here. I know that's a really big question, but whatever you feel called to speak to in this moment is wonderful.
The most delicate pursuit, I think, in my life is trying to unleash my inner child, trying to overcome the feeling like people care and the feeling of needing to behave. And I think that was a product of growing up single mom, the old New England Irish Catholic upbringing.
Sure.
Absolutely nothing my mom ever did was meant to keep me from expressing myself. It was just, that's how society is.
Right.
You get to a certain age and it's like, quit goofing around. I'm 40 years old. I want to find new ways to goof around. So that's kind of everything I'm trying to focus on doing is finding ways to dance and not feel dumb in the process.
Yeah. I love that. That's really beautiful. And I think, one, you've already mentioned, but you're a dad. And I think that that is a way that a lot of people, I mean, I'm not a parent, I don't have kids, but I would have to imagine, please correct me if I'm wrong, that awakens this new dimension of a relationship to your inner child as well. That is, there's this little being that I'm responsible for, that I want to show up for it as my wholest, truest self, but also seeing Augie play and enjoy life, I'm sure is like, wow, I also need to tap back into that.
You know, he just got good at walking. He's 18 months and he takes these short steps and he runs to me. And then I started taking short steps on my own to run to him. And then he started mimicking me and doing shorter steps. And so we have this game we play where we make eye contact and we just start running at each other with these tiny little steps. And it gets to a point where we just start like kind of like doing the running man. And you can't, like, look, I loved my life before I had a baby. I'm not one of those like, you gotta do it. I'm glad we brought a life into this world when we had all of the resources to like really focus on being great parents. And one thing I see, and by the way, anyone who has a child that's over the age of 18 months will tell me I have no idea what I'm talking about, because parents have this like parent measuring contest that they do where they wait till they're five, wait till, and it's like, okay, fine. Well, I'll get there. Okay. So just let me enjoy this amazing bliss that I have.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm my job, what I feel like my job as a dad and as a parent is I'm not, like, we brought this soul into our world. He chose us, is our belief. Like, his spirit chose us. And I'm sure he's a little pissed because we lived in California when he chose us. And then we moved to the terrible weather of, you know, middle America here. He's like, I chose you when you lived in the near Venice Beach.
Right.
But our job is to bring this beautiful boy into this world and introduce him to the challenges of the world. And I think what's going to be tough is I'm trying to live my life now, reaping the rewards of overcoming those challenges. And I'm going to have to make sure that I don't buy his access to overcoming them. And I think that's what's going to be tough, is realizing, like, I'll help you get up, but I'm going to need you to try to get up before. And whatever that looks like. And I think a lot of people want to protect their kids from that adversity. But I do believe the number one key to success in life is grit, perseverance, hard work, whatever you want to call it, far, far more than any intelligence or IQ level. It's passion. And it doesn't matter if he wants to be a passion in art or whatever. I want him to really get exposed to that feeling that we have inside that makes you feel alive, and then give him whatever resources I can to help him use those tools to achieve that.
That's so powerful. And honestly, it really reminds me a lot of how my parents raised me growing up. And a few years ago, I read this book by Angela Duckworth. It's called Grit. And it really was kind of a paradigm shift for me in thinking about how we as a society consider hard work, because I think so often it is this like nose to the grindstone, do whatever you have to do to just make it through. But in this book, she really frames it as, how can you find joy and levity and play, like you mentioned earlier, in the midst of grinding it out, right?
Like, and you'll be such a better version of yourself. I've been every version. I've had the guy whose light was completely dimmed or extinguished by my career. I've been that bitter guy on the verge of breakdowns. I had the funniest moment. Oh, it's painful to think of, but I was doing this side gig. You know, I've been in the Screen Actors Guild for 20 years. I didn't really start making money till like 5 years ago. Broke as hell, living with my wife, girlfriend at the time, then my fiance in our 500 square foot studio apartment.
Of course.
And I was doing this side gig where I drive these golf carts around, and I can't, it's like there are these little electric cars, a touristy town, and you work on minimum wage plus tips. And then, so when it's bad weather, you don't get any tips and you just kind of like, yeah, whatever, you're just there. And it gets cold. Like on the west, like Southern California on the coast gets cold.
You get that breeze off the water.
So cold, and you're not ready for it. It comes in out of nowhere. And I'm from New England. I know, you know, but it comes in and it's windy. My sister called me, and there was like a whole bunch of people back home, and I'm in like on a bad place. I'm doing like minimum wage gigs with my college degree and all of these other things. And she called me, and one of the kids, there's a lot of like cousins in the background, and they're like, "Who's on the phone?" And then my sister was like, "Your Uncle David." And then one of the kids was like, "Who?" And then the other one said, "It's the one we don't know." I'm telling you, not their fault.
Right.
I go, what is this all for? I am literally, I didn't feel like a loser so much as I didn't see light at the end of my pursuit. I didn't see, and that was probably very close to the darkest in the night before sunrise came.
Yeah.
Shortly, I mean, I'm not kidding, within months, like, I can tell you the day where I was like, I could feel that vibrational change where a lot of things I had put into place started to like, you could start to see the seedlings come up.
Yeah.
And I had faith. Like, even with faith, at some point you're like, how does my girlfriend even believe in me?
Yeah, it's the period of time where like you've entered into the dark tunnel and you don't see the light at the end of it yet. So it's pitch black behind you and it's pitch black forward. And all you can do is just faith, keep walking. And like, one day I know I'm going to see that light. One day I know I'm going to see it. And it's like that is the grit that you're talking about. And
you need the doubt. If you don't have the doubt, you don't keep walking. Like if you're not doubting, you're like, well, I guess I'm fine where I am. There was never any complacency. There's just this thing. Anyone who's done art knows you don't get paid. No one gives you a book advance until you approve an author, right? Everything you have to do is on your own time. And I was on my lunch break writing scripts and editing things and left and right. And I mean, I'm not kidding, like watching Mr. Beast videos, because at the time, Mr. Beast videos were like handing a $100 bill to a waiter. They were like very not as big as they are now, but right. He was bringing joy to people. And all these YouTubers were making videos about how much money they were making. And I was so aware that if I started to make money having ownership over what I was doing, the phrase, don't rent out your time. I knew that there's so much in return when you do that. But the sort of the trap a lot of people fall into is, did you take the first job out of college? Did you take the first offer? When you did get fired or laid off, did you take the first thing back? And I do think that the world provides us these little opportunities, and they're not always meant to be taken. Sometimes we're meant to say, that's below what I need to do. And other times you take the gig and you learn something. But I think in this minimum wage job, which I ended up getting laid off during the pandemic, when they called everyone back to the job, they didn't call me back. I was probably so unlikable to them because it was like, I didn't want to be a minimum wage person. But when I showed up to that job, I gave them the minimum wage version of myself because that's what I was. I wasn't giving them my business degree or my artist. Yeah. I was giving them like whatever. But I think what I learned was, even though I had to do what I had to do to pay the bills, I didn't consume myself with jobs that would rob my creativity. I like protected that so that I could continue to do that until I found an avenue that started to make money. As soon as that happened, it was like all hands on deck. Like, we got it. The thing works, just gasoline on top of it. And it really hasn't stopped since then.
That's so exciting. And one, congratulations. I seeing the like meteoric rise of your channel in the post like Lively Baldoni situation, it's really been cool to watch. And
I wouldn't use meteoric, but sure. I mean, it rose, I guess.
Sure. But it's
all relative, right?
Yeah, it's all relative. And it's always inspiring to see a success story, right? Even if that success is just finding the thing that makes you like, oh, this spark that I felt inside that now is a flame, and I have something to pour gasoline on now, and we're just going to go. It's just so inspiring. But I do want to ask you about, because of course, like you said, you've been in SAG for 20 plus years, you're a stand-up comedian. What was the thing that made you realize you were an artist, a creative? I think so many creatives now, we're so lucky to have social media and the internet to be able to have ownership over our time and our creative voice. But what was that first, I think you called it that piece inside of you that makes you feel alive. Do you have a memory of the first time that you felt that? And what gave you the confidence to pursue that?
It's, you know, it's a lot of, for me, Facebook came out when I was in college, and it was still just like a status update thing. There wasn't the sharing of content that there is now. So the idea that I could get into stand-up was not, I was so far out of that reality that it took so many wrong turns and getting lost, truly getting lost. I was working out of college, I worked in an advertising firm, and my job stunk. It just stunk. And again, I hope the message here isn't me complaining. It's just that when you're not doing something that you're supposed to do, it is so much harder. So much harder. In this job, it was like, ugh. But there was a creative side to the job that other people had that I didn't. And that creative side was the ones that did the design work. And they worked on the floor where they had open concept desks because they were the creatives. I was on the business side, which is the soul-sucking, I was on the wrong team. And I became friends with these creative folks. And then one day, even though my job wasn't creative at all, just being exposed to people that had bold ideas, there was like this 48-hour film festival. And, you know, we're going to make a project. We need actors. We need it. And I said, I want to act. I want to do something. I want to perform. It was my inner child wanting to play in a world that was a dress code. You don't get to do that. You didn't go to art school, so you don't get to play. And I think a lot of comedians, the comedian lawyer crossover is big, because I think a lot of people get into law because I could be wrong, but I think they get into law because of the performance aspect, where you want to, you're debating, and it's a sign of IQ, and we learn and we go back and forth, and then they realize that most lawyers, it sucks so much that you go to one open mic and you're like, I'm done. I'm doing the comedy. I can do this in a different world. So for me, I didn't even do that film fest. Something didn't work out, but it was enough to see the email to know that existed, that then they said, all right, we'll join this community. And then next thing you know, I'm like on Craigslist taking like Emerson College or University acting gigs. And I didn't have a headshot. I had like a business card, and I was just right for a few of the parts. And then there, that buddy gets me. And next thing you know, I'm doing, you know, I don't know, stand-in and background work. And I got cast in this project that became a feature film where I had a whole bunch of scenes in it. And they believed in me when they shouldn't have. Like, I didn't have anything, but I was like excited and naive and dumb. And it was enough in that community to branch off. And that turned into moving to New York and taking some improv classes. And I remember the moment we had our first Upright Citizens Brigade class. we had our class show and we're behind the wall and there's 10 people in the audience. They're all friends and we're getting ready to perform in this surreal. I'm in New York City. I'm performing like inner child. Just play, play, play. Someone from that class was a comedian. Oh my gosh, you do stand up? Now she's one of my good friends, Katie. And I didn't know she did stand up. And how do you get into that? Questions, asking, just really sinking my teeth into any opportunity,
yeah.
Which just led to more and more comedy. And then, to write a joke and perform it on stage, I still try to find, like, I still feel stiff and rigid, and I'm still trying to like break out. Like it's the Forrest Gump metaphor, like the, you know, it's just getting those braces off. And that'll be a lifetime thing, you know.
Totally.
But that's the journey, you know. Not waiting until I'm on my deathbed to really just like, yeah. You know, my wife's like, we got to take dance lessons for the first dance. Let's go. Now I was a little resistant. I got us last minute dance lessons, but like we were in LA. We were like 2 weeks before we had, you know, to go to our wedding, and we hadn't done a dance lesson, and we ended up getting set up with someone who was on like the Dancing with the Stars like regional tour.
Oh, how fun.
But they were like, they had studied under Louis Van Amsel, like one of the Dancing with the Stars people. And like, so next thing you know, we're like Viennese waltz, and we did double sessions for 2 weeks straight. And it was like, yeah, well, I get a chance to perform. We got a chance like with my wife, and that was the final pre-wedding test, right? The stress of getting married is so like the wedding industrial complex is just meant to rob you, and not everyone makes it through it. And that last phase for us to learn how to not just communicate emotionally, but physically, like physical communication, not stepping on each other's toes, unbelievable. And that's like part of the whole racket. Why you take these opportunities, because it's like, what world would I not want to do that?
Yeah, there's always the lesson in whatever it is. And I grew up dancing, and there is something so unique about the physical expression of art and this feeling. And when you do it with someone, especially that you love so deeply, it's like, oh, this is a new level of being in sync. But I did want to ask, I want to go back to when you said all of these friends and like buddies and friend of friends that see your business card, and then you start learning these things and you get the bigger and bigger and bigger role. And you said they believed in me when they shouldn't have, because you didn't have anything. And I just want to throw something out there. It's not even a question, but see how it hits you and what you think. I think what you did have is that curiosity, that desire to play, that spark, the thing that you couldn't ignore. And I wonder if that's what people were seeing, that it's like, doesn't matter if he has the right headshot, doesn't matter if he has the right agent, if he has the manager, if he has the SAG eligibility, whatever. There's something here, and that's the type of people that we want to work with, that like-minded people that you want to surround yourself with, right? Hello, everyone. It's Reese just briefly interrupting this wonderful conversation with Dave to ask you how you're enjoying it. And let me know in the comments down below, when was the last time that your inner child got to play? I was really reflecting on that in editing this episode, and I was like, it's been a hot minute, and I should probably do something about that. So let me know. When's the last time your inner child has played, and what was it that felt like play to you? Also, I want to remind you to subscribe wherever you may be listening and or watching. Follow the Cohere Collective at the Cohere Collective wherever you have social media, and head to www.thecoherecollective.com to check out all of our other offerings. There you can also learn about working with me one-on-one to find and pursue your purpose. And I think that's all I have for you. Let's jump back into the episode.
Yeah, Yeah, totally. And you know, I think it's Mike Tyson said, we all have a plan until we get punched in the face. And like, I hadn't failed
sure.
yet. I mean, don't get me wrong. I wasn't nailing every audition, but I got like my first few months into that world, I got cast in an ABC pilot. It's still the most professional thing I've ever been cast in. And it didn't make it, but it was still, it was a full shoot with a lead actress that as a kid was like the heartthrob. And it was like, I was like, what the hell am I doing here? But it was, I didn't have theater training. So I didn't have years of professors telling me how high the brick wall was that you needed to get over. So there is like a dumb luck. There is a beginner's luck that comes from not understanding limitation. Once you understand limitation, it holds you back because, you know, the Randy Posh quote, like the brick wall's not meant to keep you out. It's meant to show you how bad you want something, right? So some of the best things I've gotten in life is just like sliding in the back door. Mm. And it happens all the time. Like I live in Nashville now. So I left LA, you know, when we started our family and had a baby just to get a little more space. I get more work in like sketch comedy, more paid stand-up. And there's limitations to not being in that big city, but there's a little bit more freedom to be like, I belong here. I've done comedy for a long time. And coming up and spending so many years in LA, and what made it kind of so dark for me is that you're competing against so many people that are also so good. There's just like, it's like we're all fighting for a limited stage time. I mean, I'm competing. I'm doing open mics with the guy who hosted American Idol season one with Ryan Seacrest before they fired him. The guys who won Last Comic Standing, like in any other world, at any other time period, they're all headliners doing their own thing. And yet there we are not like, so it took a lot of, you know, it ebbs and flows the believing in yourself. Mm-hmm. And what my success on YouTube podcasting has given me the chance. It's given me a little bit of that confidence that knows like I'm not in the deep end. I'm still splashing in the water, but I have the ability to do things on my own terms. And everything I do now with the podcasting and YouTube, it's like parallel to my goals. It's still like there's a lot of ownership to what I do. It's a trillion times better pay, but there's still like we're not there. And I have to know that I still have limitations and I need to like overcome those so that I can do the theater gigs and I can do the gigs that are purely for the inner child's not like, well, we got to make a video because it's a lot closer to the goal, but it's not there.
Right. But it's taking those steps like through the darkness of the cave. Right. And it's like you said, that journey is the lifetime journey. One thing that I did want to ask about, because like you said, this journey of unleashing your inner child and that just kind of being this driving force in your life. I am really fascinated with your shift into political commentary. I completely agree with your ethos that it's deeply important that we're talking about these things, but to start as a bachelor in entertainment commentary channel and now to be doing something that you got a little bit of lashback for from your community. And of course, we know Bachelor Nation can be a bit conservative and all of that good stuff. But
the people don't like me? What? I turned off the comments. This is the first I've heard it.
What? But what was it that really pushed you into the need to talk about it? Because I know for me, I have people who love me dearly and support my work that are like, don't touch it. Don't touch it. It's going to do nothing but blow up and make people angry. And I'm like, so what? I have to stay true to that. And I have to be speaking about these things that matter. So talk to me about that choice for you. And even though
I was radicalized by Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hell yeah.
That old Brooklynite got to me. I never had any principles of like, well, we separate these conversations. It was a lack of knowledge. Nothing I ever did in my life, I felt like I never felt the politics mattered. Mm. I couldn't, if someone was like, Dave, you voted for George Bush, I don't even know who I voted for in college. If I did, I don't remember voting till like Obama in New York. which was funny because I remember walking back to my apartment in Harlem, and I remember like this black dude rolls his windows down and he's like, "Obama won, F you." Like, and I was like, "Hey, I voted for the guy."
Like I'm excited.
He was just like excited and he just saw me walking. But it was like, and in New York City is amazing. And it's so you can feel the magic of movements and this idea of the big P politics. It's like, I covered Bachelor because of this social dynamic, because I enjoy humanity and love and seeing people fall in love or say the wrong thing and fall out of it in the fights. Like, I covered it because
it was fascinating.
It was a simple common denominator, the number one, water cooler show that covers all of that. So that made perfect sense. My shift into other things is really the same framework, which is as a comedian, you're supposed to tell the truth, right? If I have a take like, oh man, like, you know, I got this joke about love is blind. And I'm like, I don't think it is. Like, I have a strong premise about why love's not blind. And it's like, if you believe it, talk about it and, you know, make it funny and all of that. Patrice O'Neill, the late great Patrice O'Neill, is a comedian. And he says, if you're not walking half the room, you're not doing it right. Now, maybe, you know, I've never walked half the room. I'm not like really... but in politics you risk the chance too if you take an opinion. I'm telling you what, I do comedy in one of the reddest states now, and I have a hard time finding somebody that like is upset with my opinions. We do get triggered by the left versus right. You know, it's so simple to like, it's so simple for people to say, I'm pro-life, I don't want to, that's it. And like, I've got family members that they don't dive deeper into that. And now you're seeing like the Pope, who's like, listen, pro-life doesn't end just on conception. Like, there's a lot of other things you got to do. And I think that's the point with a lot of people that have my shared beliefs, which is like living in a system that spreads out the wealth to a point where the basement's not as dark, and the basement being like affordable, basic minimum wages that people can live off of. Like, we're talking reasonable stuff, you know, like, this art was just sold. I covered this on my show yesterday. This art piece just sold for $236 million. That person's not paying enough in taxes. It wasn't even a Monet. It was like a weird piece of art. They're just doing it to money launder. Like the excesses. And everybody agrees with that. Whether they know it or not, it can be described in ways that everyone agrees with. So there's a ton that's wrong with the Democratic Party. The majority of them take money from sources where they're not looking out for people's interests. And they've learned that people would rather vote for Trump, someone that they know of and regardless of what their opinions, they rather voted for him. He won the popular vote. Even if he didn't win the popular vote, the symptom was big enough that people weren't being listened to. The fact that unions no longer support the Democratic Party, do some work on that. And I'm interviewing Dr. Annie in South Carolina, running for office. She's a pediatrician. She's an expert in childhood care. Those are the voices we need. Experts. Totally. Not experts because for any other reason than they put the time in, they're well-respected, they're vetted in their communities.
Yes.
And whether you're that or an oyster fisherman who like knows his people because he's up at dawn and works, with the God-given world around him, or someone like Zohran Mamdani, who's an immigrant who sees all of the real issues that New Yorkers face with affordability. Like, these are such common things that Trump spoke to but didn't deliver on.
Yeah,
he goes, "I'll drain the swamp because I know him." He just replaced the parts.
Yes.
So talking about it's not hard, and for those that do have a problem with it, I have to give them permission to exit the conversation.
Yeah.
And so many people, my peers, are afraid to talk about it because that exit is loud. They'll let you know. They'll let you know that they're leaving. And I just try to focus on those that have stayed. And mind you, I haven't had a ripple of a loss in my audience. I just keep on growing. So you have to be okay. And with like, I look at the Mormon wives, the show Real Love.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're all have these terrible mental health issues for a lot of different reasons. But a lot of it is they all get hate. They all get hate and shame because their religion, they have like this high purity test and no one can live up to it.
Right.
And you got Whitney. She's like seemingly like everyone hates her. And my like advice I would give her is that if a million people are exposed to you, and even if 900,000 of them hate you, maybe 100,000 love you. Like you have to, I look at it like if you're mining for gold, you could have a whole beach of sand, but that sand, you know, there's gold in there, you know, and if you can find that gold, that's yours. Just ignore the rest. So for me, yeah. I couldn't be the best version of myself for a lot of the haters. Like I'll always be whatever version they want me to be. And I heard this like saying, and I love it, that it's like, if you think I'm an asshole or if you think I'm a great guy, you probably got the version of me you deserved.
Mm.
Not always. Sometimes you're having a bad day, but a lot of times, sure. Someone wants to leave me a rude comment, man, I'm going to give you the shittiest version of me. And again, I know an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind, but sometimes I give people a taste of what they sound like and they go, oh, he's absolutely crazy. He can't. And I was like, I literally just turned the mirror on you. And
I was about to say it's mirror.
And I know I'm not unreasonable, because if I did that live in a stand-up show, the rest of the room's cheering for me. Like,
exactly.
You know, when you've flown too close to the sun, and not all comedians are good at this, but I think we battle test and sample our attitudes on a stage in front of our peers. And if you're unlikable and you don't bring the jokes and you don't do, and you're mean to somebody for the wrong reason, you lose the room and you can never get them back. That set is over.
They're gone.
And so anyway, so like, I don't have a problem with it. I try, for my own sanity, I try not to engage with too many people, but once in a while, someone might have a gripe and they seem reasonable and I'll give them a response.
Yeah. You have to kind of measure which ones are like, okay, there's a real question and there's somewhere that I can maybe have an intellectual dialogue with. And then the other ones that are just like complete ad hominem, you suck. It's like, okay, well, we're not gaining any ground there. But I completely agree, when you step into your authenticity, you're never going to be everyone's cup of tea, but you magnetize yourself like the same way a magnet has the north and south poles. You're going to push away the people that do not vibe with what you're putting out, but they weren't meant to be there anyways. But you are going to attract the people who completely get your frequency, who are on that same page. And like you said, you didn't see a dip. It's just been continued growth, because even though it may push away some people that weren't 100% aligned with whatever you're doing, it's bringing in the people that are, that want to hear what you have to say and that are excited about these conversations you're having. And I adored the interview with Dr. Annie. I had not heard of her. And I want to go. I'm following her and like all of that great stuff.
I think she could be our president in 15
kid
years.
Kid care is like one of the most brilliant, beautiful ideas. And I actually wrote down a quote that you had, because I think it's so powerful. You were talking about how the problem with Democrats has largely been trying to meet Republicans in the middle. And you said, we're starting to see how having strong, bold choices is better than being anti-Trump. And I found that so refreshing, because yes, there is a laundry list of things we could talk about to be upset at Trump about, right? Like, I know you're covering the Epstein files and all of that that's going on right now.
It's like being a food critic. Like, you're complaining that the food sucks. Make me a dish. Give me something else to eat.
Give me something to be excited about.
The lasagna's burnt. It's probably got E. coli. But I'm hungry. I need something. And just give us anything that's edible that's better than that. And instead, they're like, how about burnt bolognese? And it's like, the answers are so simple. So it's like, they've done this thing where they can rest on being anti-Trump. And it's like, the reason he exists and will continue to exist in other iterations is not a good alternative.
Right. And like you said, people are hungry for revolution. People are hungry, period. Right. And that is the universal, like, common denominator. That is the equalizer. Like, when people feel unheard and unsafe, they're going to let you know. And being in the pockets of billionaires is not good for anybody.
Yeah. What's funny is I got a lot of people that think, AOC, she's got no chance. And I'm like, you don't understand how, if presented in front of the whole Republican Party, she steals a lot of votes. Like, you don't understand that to speak as a populist, the left calls it progressives. And then, like, you have true progressives like Bernie, who really wants to have like aggressively tax the billionaires, and it is like tax the ultra, ultra wealthy to ways that they used to work. And then you've got the fake populist like Trump, who's like, we're going to drain the swamp, and then they don't actually do it. And everything's like a carve out. And, you know, it's like it's not a system that works long term. The people that voted for him, like I have a lot of family that went Bernie to Trump, and a lot of people don't understand how that works, because on the flat line, you can't see how someone could leap from a mid to far left position over to a mid to far right position. And it's because we're not looking at it right. It's three dimensional. And this large group of people, they want, you know, safety and the economy and affordability and all these things. And I've been there, because I've been in situations where I've had a social safety net, whether it's through unemployment, growing up when my mom had to get on food stamps, during the pandemic when we got paid to kind of sit on our ass for a few months while they figure things out. Like that pot needs to be there and be reliable. We need farmers that feel confident if they need to upgrade their barn that they'll be able to. Living here in Tennessee, how many people started upgrading their barns and were building things because they had this Infrastructure Act, and then it got taken away from them? There were literally like loans were taken away, and a lot of people online want to say, this is what you voted for. That doesn't get us, if you look at our country as a big family, people will understand they were duped when you stop telling them and let them kind of get out of the quicksand.
Yeah.
And it's like someone's in the quicksand. And you're like, you stepped in that. You deserve this. It's like, Bubba, we all got to get out of this so that we can be a part of a coalition that actually demands, some aid for the middle class, the lower class.
Well, and it goes back to the basic humanity piece, which is, I think, exactly what you're talking about, and the framework that connects your work with The Bachelor and with politics, that it ultimately is about human beings and this human experience. And if you drill it down to the simplest one-on-one human interaction, no one likes to hear, I told you so. Don't, like, you back a dog into the corner and they're going to bite you. You know, it's like, think about these simple pro-social things that we understand. And there's this difficulty in expanding those out to this higher level. But I absolutely agree with you. That's like, let's take a pause and really assess what it is that people are yearning for in this. And I just love the push that you've had in your content to be about that underlying cause, that underlying humanity. And what do you think it is that tapped you into that? Because of course I'm obsessed with these big questions. Like, what is that underlying root that unites us all?
I think I'm justice oriented. I have an uncle who's a priest. I have a family that's very religious, and I could call them tomorrow and be like, hey, you know, 200 bishops, 200 archbishops all just said what ICE is doing is wrong. They'd go, well, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's so, when you see how strong the resistance, like, certain people just have their radios in their car tuned to a frequency.
Yeah.
And that frequency of hate and fear takes a while to deprogram. It really does. And that's okay. You know, like, that's okay. It's as much as we would like some political leader to have a speech tomorrow that changes everybody's minds. That's not always going to happen. And the find out stage of FAFO right now is a time that's important, like Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving's one of my favorite holidays because it's, A, we're just going to say what we're grateful for. And, you know, don't forget the meaning of that. Like, what's with this gratitude? Like, where are we today? We're with our families. Like the things that really matter. But I hope that a lot of people will have conversations, and they'll see that uncle that's, you know, didn't harvest their soybeans this year. They'll see so-and-so, you know, the families that lived in fear for that one week they didn't get SNAP benefits, or whatever the case may be.
Right.
And I think I have faith that with all of that deprogramming comes a country that sees this whole culture war around, you know, Doge, getting rid of USAID because we were sending peanut butter to some countries in Africa, you know, for emergency famines. We were getting so upset about that. We didn't get a dollar back when it was all cut. The person in charge of it just became a trillionaire. And I think people really will understand this. And, you know, it's a lot to tie in. Like, the Epstein files are about so many different things. But
totally.
When it all comes together, you start to see the picture getting painted. That's like, at some point, the curtain does get exposed on the Wizard of Oz. And you see a exploitative billionaire from Queens, New York, who doesn't care what's happening to your kids in Alabama.
Yeah.
And at that point, every single person whose mind is shifted, you never see the polling go back. Trump will never get the toothpaste back in the tube. But like I said, he's serving up some shitty, sloppy Joe. Who is going to serve something better? And a lot of that's happening. We're seeing it pop up in different ways. James Tallarico is the perfect Christian alternative to the fear, because he's saying, this is what God actually said. This is why he believes in separation of church and state. He has walked that walk, and he can speak to those people in that way. That's why Dr. Andy can speak about why the medicine's so important that we bring faith back into that. So all of these people are emerging, and yet the Democratic Party, the leadership, still didn't want Zohran Mamdani. Whether it's Democrat, Republican, old guard, right? Old guard is going to do old guard things. Bernie Sanders would have been president if he might have had 6 more months. He was surging when Hillary Clinton had already locked down all of her delegates, and he was on top. And that was the answer. And that radical, bold ideas that, why does a banker who pushes numbers around in New York City, why is he worth $1,700 an hour when a farmer working with their hands and knees and bleeding, why is that, we're never as, we're never worth as much or as little as these pay discrepancies are.
Yes.
Now but that doesn't mean everybody gets 30 an hour. That's it. No matter what you do. No, you could if the minimum wage is raised to a livable place where you don't need 17 jobs, you inject that money back into the economy. You still work hard because everyone, I prayed and prayed and prayed for opportunity to have a job that paid me enough money to continue doing stand up.
Yes.
All I wanted for my YouTube, my nut, my break even, was so low about 8 months into the pandemic. So I've been laid off for 8 months, not 8 or 9 months. I saw a little blip on YouTube. I was making $3 a day, maybe less. But when I released a video, I'd get $3 the next day. I see this little blip. And then I covered a story, and then it kind of took off, and then it kind of plateaued. And then a day later, YouTube started recommending it again. And I was like, oh. Yeah. We've never done the second plateau. We've gotten through that first door, but not the second one.
Yeah.
And then when it hits, YouTube's like, hey boys, bring this one in. And then next thing you know, it's like, whoa. And I was in Malibu with my wife, my girlfriend at the time. And I had plans to propose. I think I ended up proposing several months later, actually. So it was all in the works. And I'm in Malibu. And I was like, internet's really bad on the beach. I checked my YouTube, it's $3, $4, or $5 a day. And the previous day kicked in, and I was like, I got a good bump this day. Let's see where it's at. $81. And I was like, I can live off of that. And I spent it all on dumplings that night. I said, honey, we're getting dumplings. And she's heavy handed with the way she orders food. She's like, give it all to me. And then, she's got the inability to choose what she wants. So there's a lot of,
try it all
tomorrow. She's a girl math, right? Well, that'll be good for later. So I'm like, all right, honey, chill out. And then we're back at, what's it called? A Smart and Final. It's like a grocery store in LA. And we're waiting in line. You have to, the lines during the pandemic at this place, you had a bouncer to get in. And then the lines wrapped all the way around the produce, like a big, long, so we're in a 15 minute line. And this is a couple days later from that first initial blip. And I check, and it's $450 that day. And I go, honey. And I mean, memories exist because of the adrenaline rush that you get.
The feeling imprint.
I go, honey, we can, this is, whoa. And she's like, and she's always been supportive. Oh, great, honey. She's supportive when it's $3 a day. She's like,
right.
God damn. Like, what?
Yeah.
And that happened for like 2 or 3 days at that $450 level. And this was like August of 2020. And then it kind of like went away. Like YouTube, something happened and the money kind of went away, but I was like, but it's there. The business model is there. And then come Christmas time, some stories broke out that were a little bit different than things I normally cover. Cause at the time I was covering, here's what happened on The Bachelor. Now I'm starting to cover, here's what happened off the show, like the parasocial relationships. And It was Claire Crowley and Dale Moss breaking up. And I was like, honey, I think I got to make a video right now. And I didn't normally do that. I make one video a week. And so I made this video, and this is like the time between Christmas and New Year's, and that takes off. And I was like, and again, it sounds so dumb, but I was like, well, if that did well, what if I just made another one? I was like, what's the law of diminishing returns? And I just started making, and then come January 1st, I was like, let's do this every day. And my January was like $6,600. My February, $20,000. My March, $25,000. It petered off a little bit after that.
Sure. But there's the peaks and valleys.
And my biggest concern, not because I was trying to dupe the system, but my biggest concern was, now I won't be able to get unemployment, because I was so broke and jobless in the pandemic that I was so focused on making sure that unemployment check came through.
Right.
Not realizing that on the 21st of every month, starting that day all the way till now, 5 years later, on the 21st of every month, Google sends me a direct deposit for a lot of money. So that was the moment where I had to shift my and go, fuck the unemployment. Like, we're done with that. We're done. Yeah. And that was the last time I ever needed it. And now my wife, you know, who was the breadwinner, she was the one who was making more. Now she's at home raising a family, and it's like the family business. And it's all because I attacked when I saw like it's starting to work.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Like you said earlier, like, oh, the spark is now a flame. Pour all the gasoline on it that we can, like, find what works and replicate it.
Every tool that I had, bring it in. And I had bought this cord. I still have it. It's attached to something here. It was $104. It was the cord that connected my nice camera to my computer. This cord made it so that I didn't have to have a memory card that I shot something and then put it on the computer, so I could see what I was doing, hit play. And my wife, you know, God bless her. She's like, do you need it's a cord, but it was a special cord.
Right.
There was no cheaper version of it at the time. I was like, I think I got to get it. And then that became, well, I got to get the $800 mixer. And I started investing in things because I could. And this is kind of like why, when I talk about, having an infrastructure that helps people, new businesses, tax write-offs, when you're starting, oh, I can write this off. I got to get that and this and that. And it just, all the tools were there to help me now that I knew how to use the tools. Like, it's like, the whole band was there. I had all the instruments. I just didn't know now that does that. And then next thing you know, I got all 17 monitors and lights and neons and it all in one. Like, I just bought this teleprompter. It's this big, you know, it's a couple $100, but I'm getting these ad reads, and I really felt like by reading the ads off to the side and not directly to camera, it was just like not giving that connection that I normally have. And that immediately pays off because I'm now really being more authentic, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just when you do all the right things, even though you don't even know what the recipe is, the dish you're making is going to work out.
We just
don't know what all the ingredients are because we're all unique.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I want to go back to what you said about really praying for this. And like, this is what you're working towards. And as soon as you see it, it's like, jump on it. But, you know, you also mentioned having a lot of religious people in your family that's their livelihoods. And at the beginning, you said that you believe, you know, your son chose you and your wife. I want to hear more about the spiritual aspect of all of this too. Dreaming and wishing, but also believing in this grander plan, perhaps. How would you describe what's really going on here? And how do you think that fed into this journey that you're on now?
I believe that we are meant to challenge ourselves. Like, I believe our souls come to this human existence to overcome. And I believe when we avoid the thing we're meant to overcome, we keep getting shown that same level. And yeah. It's shown in different ways. It's Groundhog's Day. And that level can last a week or 10 years or your lifetime. And that's what, like, for me, spiritual evolution, it's overcoming that level, learning how to respond to adversity, then learning where the adversity is, like sidestepping it completely, and like different ways to leapfrog over it. And what might have been the biggest hang up in my life 10 years ago is done by sunrise. And it's, and then you get presented with the new. And this is why when people like really make it, they always go like, you know, money's not everything. And it's like, when you're broke, you're like, yeah, shut the hell up.
Yeah.
And there's truth to both sides, where money provides you time and opportunity. But
exactly.
So many people that hit the lottery, and I argue with my wife over this. She's like, I'm perfectly fine if we win $700 million. I'm like, let me tell you something. If I win $700 million, I'm waking up with $700 million in my bank account, and I'm wondering what the hell I need to do to make my life happen. Like, I don't, that's not how, like, there's a curse that people receive when they're provided everything, whether by their parents or whatever. There's a curse. And I think the world needs to be hard enough that you get the value when you overcome something, but not so hard that you don't even get off your starting blocks.
Yeah.
And so for me, spiritually, I think my mom was really spiritual. She used to say stuff like, you know, before a baseball game, she'd be like, you need to visualize getting a hit. And I'm like, Mom, shut. What are you talking? I need to take batting practice. Like, what do you?
Yeah.
And it's like, you need to do batting practice and you need to visualize. You need you need muscle memory, so your brain can properly execute the commands that the soul wants it to do. There's a book. I'm trying to remember what it's called. It's about healthy habits, and it's a book about your muscle memory is you harden the neural pathways, so you make these super tunnels that are direct connections between what you need to do, and that's why when you see a pro baseball player take a curveball to the opposite field and they have a split second to change the whole physics of their swing in order to succeed, it's because they have been in this situation time and again. Tom Brady was a student of nonstop studying his opponents. He knew the defense better than they knew it. He knew where they were going to go based on the color of their knuckles, because when they had their knuckles down hard, it meant they were going to attack, versus when they were soft, it meant they were going to pull back into a different coverage. Like, these are the things that no one else would know if they weren't, as hadn't spent years learning that. And as a comedian, you learn about the energy of the room in a lot of cases before you get on stage.
Oh,
and it's still hard because it's still so many variables, right? So for me, I try to tap into the spirituality, and I try to avoid the religion, because religion has failed me and so many people in so many ways. And I'm not an anti-religion guy. I had it easy. I had New England Catholicism. Show up or don't, they don't care. I didn't have Southern purity culture. I didn't have evangelical, like, we got to wear t-shirts in the pool. So I didn't have any of that. We had it so, maybe women had it differently, but like, dude, growing up, insulated, not a big deal. My father, my stepdad, very conservative, very Catholic. And I think he's a product of what worked for that generation. And I think now it's like, go to church, do whatever the hell you want to do. But if a church is preaching something that like completely contradicts what Jesus' message was, which is to help the poor, in all of the other ways that we help humanity out, I have no problem calling that out. And
yeah.
I'm glad to see real Christians do that. And,
yeah.
And, you know, people like Zohran Mamdani, like, he's not a Christian. And yet he does more Jesus Christ-like things and has pledged to do more Jesus Christ-like things than so many people that put the cross on and say, you know what? I'm pro-life, so I'll take the rest of the week off. Like,
yeah.
And then like me, I'm just going, well, that's bullshit. You know, you all sold me on this like moral direction. And now I feel like, I'm like, hey, I thought we were protecting the First Amendment. I thought we were all about taxing the rich and doing this. And now all of a sudden, because you're on the winning side, you're like, no, for, you know, whatever. So
Yeah.
It's calling out people that aren't living up to whatever they claim to be, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and as a Texan, you know, you mentioned James Tallarico earlier, and I don't consider myself a Christian, but was certainly raised. That's the water we swim in, one in the United States, but especially in Southern Baptist Texas. And it is so refreshing to see people that are like reading the red text in the Bible and saying, okay, what did Jesus actually say? What are the things that we're actually going to implement here? And it makes me have this like change in how I hold myself that it's like, sure, I don't consider myself religious anymore, but I'm proud that there are people that are fighting for the good that can be found in these sacred texts and in these sacred moments.
You know, you find a lot of in Christianity is you find a lot of, you know, well-meaning people, but that shirt is tucked in so tight, those dress boots are laced up, and it's like, and then on the other end, it's kind of like on the Titanic, right? Yeah, the socioeconomic level.
Yeah.
Like, what do you want to do? You want to dress up like all of the stuffy people, or you want to go dance with the Irish? And Kate Winslet wanted to go dance with the Irish. Yeah. She was shackled by this, like,
letting her inner child play. By dancing with the Irish.
Yeah, and that's what it all is, right? So I get into acting. I get into stand up. I'm you know, I'm at a gay bar or just a normal bar that, and you know, people express their sexuality.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see so much of you know, gay is supposed to be happy, right? It is like the court jester or Shakespeare. It's play. And
yeah.
And for whatever reason, a lot of the gay community can play.
Yeah.
And a lot of, and again, I know I'm generalizing, so people go, no, that's not true. There's plenty of like, you know, straight churches where, sure, okay, but I'm coming from like the stiff Catholic church where like the incense comes and
bend your knee
and like, well, peace be with to you. And it's like, okay, fine. Yeah, sure. Great. But like dance, play, laugh, be merry. And the gay community like was a welcoming home to that. So like, it was so great when I moved to New York City and I'm like living in a Dominican neighborhood and the energy there was like Friday nights, the trunk of the cars popped open, music's blasting, people are laughing. It was so vibrant. And
yeah.
Then you go and then you take the one train down and you're right there in Chelsea. And it's like, I grew up in a very quiet, suburban world and I just craved that music, because it does allow you to kind of dip into it and not feel like the security cameras are on you.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm like, that's the joy of humanity, of human experience, right? It's experiencing all of the dimensions of what it means to be here in this life. And that's what needs to be protected by all of these other things that we're talking about in a more governance sphere. And I completely agree there. Is a certain level of like acceptance it because of the freedom that certain minority groups have had to curate and generate for themselves in community. And it's so beautiful. I also want to ask, when did you first kind of land on the language of letting your inner child play? Because I know that like inner child work and shadow work has recently become more popular in like self-development, self-help and spiritually spheres. But when was that click for you?
You know, that's a good question. And I don't know. But I do know when I was in college, there was like The Secret was popular.
Yeah.
And I felt like I needed evidence of the law of attraction.
Totally.
I needed a little bit more science involved. And I think I got that from Wayne Dyer, his Power of Intention. He explained that like we are all kind of like a light tower.
Yeah.
Where we give off, or like a radio tower, we give off this energy and we'll get whatever back we give out. And that for me, I've just been aware, and maybe it was brought more to light by being on stage, that I'll look back on and I'll kind of feel unlikable if I don't walk on stage with a smile. And I just have to remind myself, maybe my like base neutral, it doesn't feel welcoming, and present to the world this positivity. And then they lighten up. And that's like, you're a single guy. You walk into a bar, smile. Come on, like have fun, laugh. What are you laughing about? Doesn't matter. Just, it's great. We're having fun. Like be like, there are ways to sort of fabricate it, fake it till you make it, so that you can kind of get going. You know, my audience, I have my private community, and I'll be like having a bad day. And then when I hit record, I try to just like bring some better energy because I do not need to pull anybody down,
yeah,
you know? And that, and it doesn't mean it's toxic positivity. We all have rough days, but like,
sure,
there is, it's not like there's a limited amount of like abundance in our soul. You can just choose to see situations in a better light. And every day is a challenge because we can be the worst version of ourselves or the best. And in really taking a moment to like harvest that and warm up that internal temperature really can help expand that. So inner child, I think I probably heard that term and I was probably like, yeah, like that's a good way to physically think of, I can see my childhood photo and there, trust me, there are so many moments with having my own son that I think of how much trauma I had not having a dad. Just natural stuff, like, you know, sure. my you know, I can like carry him into the shower and then I can like hold him and like wash him, and there was one time when he like fell asleep, he was so tired he like fell asleep in the shower. I was like, honey, look at this. And I think like, oh my gosh, like it might sound crazy, but like I never had a dad, so I didn't even know what my body would look like when I got older. Versus having a son now who gets to have all of the abundance. And there's a comedian I like, Robert Kelly. He had like a couple and my stepdad's great, but I was like, you know, I was developed. My inner child was kind of already a lonely kid by that point. And Robert Kelly, you know, his therapist, you know, would say, hey, look, here's the deal. You don't get to have a father. You get to be a father. And I can apply the lessons I've learned from my stepdad and other men in my life. And I can try to apply that to my son to be something he can look up to, and also all of the other things that come with it. I think my parents' generation did the best they could. I always say everyone tries the best with the information they have.
Absolutely.
They had like a pamphlet, and we have the internet. So I'll scroll dad talk, and in 1 minute, I'll get better advice than they ever got in their entire lives.
Yeah.
And you see like the best advice is always like encouragement and letting them know you see them. For their effort. And, you know, there's a reason why you're not like trying to, you know, judge a 7-year-old by whether they scored the goal or not, because you're not going to score the goals all the time in life. Like my adult life has been a majority failure, and yet I'm doing okay now. So all of those lessons, and again, you know, he's still a baby, but like all of those lessons, I look forward to the moments where I can try to apply them in ways that teaches those values to him, which is going to be tough because like, I'm going to want to shower him with money and opportunity. And I'm just going to have to, you know, that's the codependent. Like all we want to do is be like, oh, you need that. Here you go. And it's like, okay, that, you know, you got to teach them the skills, not just provide them the outcome.
Right. Absolutely. I just, in that encapsulation of this, I'm just also so much hearing the way that this gift of being a father is not just being a father to your little one, but it's also practicing what it would have been like to be a father to yourself, right? There's this really beautiful, like, healing that it sounds like happens. Well,
let me
there.
Tell you something. You don't even know your wounds until sometimes they emerge. And it's almost like expelling like a sickness. You're just like, and I'm not talking like, I don't know if I've had an experience where I've like had like a shudder cry, but I do remember my mother son dance on my wedding. My mom had that. Just lost it.
Yeah.
And she's always, this was so funny. It's always embarrassing, but you know, every Thanksgiving, she's the one who's going to cry. And she's always been good at sharing her gratitude for everything. But when I was young, she left my father when she was pregnant with me. So she has tremendous guilt for a lot of those life choices. James Tallarico was just on a podcast talking about how his mom left his abusive father when he was just a baby. And that I see our parents that are there and those that weren't. I see that they all tried their best. I have like nothing but love for my biological father. He passed away. He was a Vietnam vet. He was rejected by society. He was sick from Agent Orange, which messes up your brain. Yeah. He had all of these issues at an age where I was playing baseball with my friends. So yeah. Like, I have so much empathy for that. And part of, you know, when you talk about like, why talk politics? It's like, because there's nobody in office who would put their kid into a situation that they're letting happen, whether it be the war they're trying to start in Venezuela or bombing someone. And, you know, so it's about like, it's about knowing what's right and wrong. And with my son, exposing myself to how like lonely my inner child was, every feeling I have now, even when I'm in tears, it's gratitude. It's like, I already had everything I wanted in life. And it's still an expanding, unwrapped layer of new moments of gratitude. Yeah. What my son, like, you know, he's about to wake up from his nap, and I'm going to open that door and it makes this little creaky noise. I could fix that creaky noise. But when that creaky noise, he turns around, he patters over to me. Like we had these little child locks. He broke them from shaking the door down. Like that's a kid who wants to hang out with me.
Yeah.
Like that's, you can't, there's no $236 million painting that can buy that.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That really is just, again, it taps back into that underlying humanity. And it's like, isn't that feeling, whatever that looks like for anyone, what we're all wanting? And being able to cultivate that is just so special. I do want to be respectful of your time, so we'll go into my ending two questions. Firstly, for everyone that's listening and watching, please go support Dave and the Rush Hour podcast. Links to check out his work, the podcast, his stand-up, all of the important stuff, social media channels will be in the description box down below wherever you may be listening or watching. So please go support Dave. Is there anything else that you would like to specifically promote? And in light of our conversation, is there anything we missed that we didn't talk about that you're like, you know, I really want to throw this out there too?
Well, I'll just say this, like, it's always easy to hear a story from someone when they found their light. But I just got to remind people, it's like, it's fresh in the rearview mirror. Like, you keep digging, keep pulling, like, in whatever direction feels good in your heart. Like, just keep saying yes to opportunities and asking questions and going to places where the experts are that do the thing that you have any curiosity about. I mean, I don't even promote it, but I do this private YouTube membership where I just like audit people's YouTube channels and respond to questions. And it's totally not worth my time. Like, it's not. I always feel good after, because I'm like, man, we got like a vegan chef. We got like a lady who's doing sing-alongs like Miss Rachel. And we got people that want to do all these different things. And I'm like, man, how cool is it that we all live in a world where we can pick up our phone and connect in that type of way? Yeah. That's the beauty of the internet, is it's like, it'll be your biggest enemy, or it'll lead you to the biggest success. And I think when you tune the frequency and like really harden like your boundaries, you'll go in the right direction. You just have to, like, you know, everything else has sort of disappeared. That's why, like, you know, now it's like, yeah, I don't get the alerts when, like, if I think I said something that will get unnecessary hate, I don't need to hear from people, because like, I've thought about it and it doesn't mean I'm in an echo chamber. It just means, even when you try not to be like, even when you try not to hear anything, like, you're still gonna, shit's still gonna get through. So yeah. Like, I see a lot of people dealing with so much pain, and it's all because they can't put that phone down. And the key is, find out how to use it as a tool and find out how to regulate that so that it doesn't take away the dopamine and the happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a beautiful note to end on. But I do have one final question to hopefully put a bow or a button on this beautifully expansive conversation. What is one word to describe how you are feeling right now?
Oh man, that's not fair. well, let me work my way to the word. I feel happy, content, gratitude. I feel all those things. I feel I also feel like a burning desire to achieve more I feel like my window of opportunity is there, and I'm just finding new ways to attack it. so that the second half of my life can be like in a teacher dad role. So I don't know how to, in one word, I mean, happy, super simple. Just I'm happy.
Yeah, I love it. Dave, thank you so much again for being here, for sharing your story with us. It really has been such a privilege.
Yeah, I appreciated talking to you today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you all so very much for being here. And of course, a huge thank you to Dave for his time, energy, vulnerability, and openness during this conversation. It's rare that I start a conversation and someone is just so willing so immediately to go there. Oftentimes there's like a little warm-up phase and, you know, we need to break the ice and kind of get comfortable, you know? I don't often have deep friendships with everyone that I'm interviewing or talking to, and Dave was just so ready to jump into the meat of it, which of course, as if you're a listener, you'll know is my favorite stuff to talk about. But it's just so rewarding to be able to spend time with another human being who wants to dig in to exactly like we talked about in this episode, that thread of humanity, of the human experience that exists underneath and in between and around and through all of the different things that we experience. And just spend some time sitting there, dwelling in that, the stuffness, the itness, the humanness of this life, of this experience. So again, a huge thank you to Dave. And I will also reiterate, please head to the description box down below, wherever you may be listening or watching, to learn all about Dave, all of his work, where you can find him doing stand-up, and where you can listen to him twice daily on your rush hour drives to and from work or wherever you may be heading to stay up to date on all things pop culture, news, politics, and fun stuff too. Again, if you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to Making Meaning wherever you're listening or watching, subscribing to the Cohere Collective here on YouTube, giving this video a like, and leaving me a comment down below letting me know, when was the last time you let your inner child play? Or you felt your inner child playing, or that your inner child was begging to be set free and allowed to play. Because sometimes I think we feel that call, but we shut it down for a variety of reasons. But sometimes we get in our own ways too. Also, you can follow us at the Cohere Collective wherever you have social media. It's the best place to stay up to date on all things Cohere, as well as learn more about me, what coherence is, and what the mission of the Cohere Collective is, what it is that I'm doing here, talking about meaning, the human experience, purpose, and coherence. We also just released our new weekly newsletter called The Muse Letter that will bring you weekly insights for cultivating coherence. And you can find that over at our website, www.thecoherecollective.com. Over there, you can also learn about the coherent design process, which is where you work one-on-one with me to find and pursue your purpose. This is some of the most rewarding work that I get to do through my job, which is crazy even I still am floored by using that language to talk about this. So if you're interested in that, I definitely recommend heading on over to our website. And if you have questions, comments, concerns, anything at all, definitely leave it in the comments down below. Head on over to social media. DMs are always open, and I'm ready to have a conversation with you. A huge thank you to Nicole O'Striker for Making Meaning's art and podcast cover. You can find her on Instagram at Nicole O Creates and Nicole O Designs, both linked down below. And a huge thank you to Tristan Morgan, the creator of Making Meaning's podcast music. And you can find him on Instagram at Tristan Morgan, linked down below as well. Right now, I am feeling... every time I ask guests for one word, I know what a difficult question it is, and that's why I always force myself to do this at the end of every episode. I'm trying to keep myself honest by saying one question of how I feel here in this moment ending this episode, and I'm having trouble coming up with one singular word for how I feel right now. So I'm feeling like I'm getting back into the swing of things. Hopefully one word will come to me, but This last week, I was traveling for Thanksgiving, which was absolutely lovely. I got to spend a lot of great time with my family and relaxing and reading, which I feel like I haven't done in ages, even though I say I read every night before bed. How often does that actually happen? And now being back in the swing, of course, it takes a little bit of time to get back into the routine. And it's interesting after a break. You know, I scheduled out a lot of content to be going out while I was gone, but I wasn't really on social media, like, at all. And I came back to some negative comments, which is always an interesting experience. When I first started getting negative comments, it was hard at first, and I think any content creator will tell you about what that feels like. And I think even in this episode, Dave says it's kind of like a trial by fire where you need to burn away the part of yourself that cares about what other people think. And I think after taking this break and coming back, I'm still feeling that getting back into the swing of it, but also hopefully, and I'm kind of resolved to have this next thing that I say be true, really let that last piece of that die for me. That sounds kind of dramatic, but truly, like, burning off this last bit of myself that cares so much about what other people think and other people's responses, and just settling into creating what I'm passionate about and talking about the things that matter to me, because I think that is ultimately what matters to most of us, right? It's purpose. It's the human experience. It's why the hell are we here? And the more that I find myself really speaking to the truth of my experience, the more that, again, like we talk about in the episode, it magnetizes the right people to you and it'll push the wrong people away. But in that process, of course, there's some growing pains. So yeah, maybe growing pains is a good word for it. Maybe burning. Ooh. Maybe like phoenix is the word I'm going to use, which is such a like ephemeral and esoteric word to use that's like not actually a feeling word. But I think that's the word I'm going to use because I still feel like maybe I'm burning a little bit. But we all know what happens after the phoenix is burned up. It rises from the ashes. Gloriously, which also makes me think of one of my favorite poems by Sylvia Plath, Lady Lazarus. Highly recommend you read it if you have not already. It's a pretty quick read, but there's a lot there to unpack. So I'll link it down below if you're interested. And I believe that's all I have for you. If you've made it all the way here to the very end of the outro, thank you again so very much for being here. And to everyone that listened, that came along for this ride, thank you so much for being my favorite part of Making Meaning and of the Cohere Collective. And as always, I hope you feel like you are living more coherently. Until next time, love.